started talking to the drivers. Bulwer and Charlie found a little shop and bought a bag of hard-boiled eggs. When they came out, Ilsman had found a driver and negotiated the price. The driver proudly pointed out his car. Bulwer looked at it in dismay. It was a Chevrolet, around 15 years old, and it looked as if it still had the original tires.
He says we'll need some food, Charlie said.
I got some eggs. Maybe we'll need more.
Bulwer went back into the shop and bought 3 dozen oranges. They got into the Chevrolet and drove to a filling station. The driver bought a spare tank of fuel and put it in the trunk.
Where we are going, there are no gas stations, Charlie explained.
Bulwer was looking at a map. Their journey was about 500 miles through mountain country. Listen, he said. There is no way this car is going to get us to the border by 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon.
You don't understand, Charlie said. This man is a Turkish driver.
Oh, boy, said Bulwer,
and he sat back in the seat and closed his eyes. They drove out of town and headed up into the mountains of central Turkey. The road was of dirt and gravel with enormous potholes, and in places it was not much wider than the car. It snaked over the mountainsides with a breathtaking sheer drop at one edge. There was no guardrail to stop an incautious driver shooting over the precipice into the abyss. But the scenery was spectacular, with stunning views across the sunlit valleys, and Bulwer made up his mind to go back one day with Mary and Stacy and Keisha and do the trip again at leisure. Up ahead, a truck was approaching them. The cabbie braked to a halt. 2 men in uniform got out of the truck.
Army patrol, said Charlie Brown.
The driver wound down his window. Ilsman talked to the soldiers. Bulwer did not understand what was said, but it seemed to satisfy the patrol. The cabbie drove on. An hour or so later, they were stopped by another patrol, and the same thing happened. At nightfall, they spotted a roadside restaurant and pulled in. The place was primitive and filthy dirty.
All they have is beans and rice,
said Charlie apologetically as they sat down. Bulwer smiled.
I've been eating beans and rice all my life.
He studied the cab driver. The man was about 60 years old and looked tired.
I guess I'll drive for a while, said Bulwer.
Charlie translated, and the cabbie protested vehemently.
He says you won't be able to drive that car, Charlie said. It's an American car with a very peculiar gear shift.
Look, I am American, Bulwer said. Tell him that lots of Americans are black, and I know how to drive a 64 Chevy with a standard shift, for Pete's sake.
The 3 Turks argued about it while they ate. Finally, Charlie said,
You can drive, so long as you promise to pay for the damage if you wreck the car.
I promise, said Bulwer, thinking, big deal.
He paid the bill, and they walked out to the car. It was beginning to rain. Bulwer found it impossible to make any speed, but the big car was stable, and its powerful engine took the gradients without difficulty. They were stopped a third time by an army patrol. Bulwer showed his American passport, and once again Ilsman made them happy somehow. This time, Bulwer noted, the soldiers were unshaven and wore somewhat ragged uniforms. As they pulled away, Ilsman spoke, and Charlie said,
Try not to stop for any more patrols.
Why not?
They might rob us.
That's great, thought Bulwer.
Near the town of Maras, 100 miles from Adana, and another 400 from Van, the rain became heavy, making the mud and gravel road treacherous, and Bulwer had to slow down even more. Soon after Maras, the car died. They all got out and lifted the hood. Bulwer could see nothing wrong. The driver spoke, and Charlie translated.
He can't understand it. He's just tuned the engine with his own hands.
Maybe he didn't tune it right, said Bulwer.
Let's check a few things. The driver got some tools and a flashlight out of the trunk, and the 4 men stood around the engine in the rain, trying to find out what had gone wrong. Eventually, they discovered that the points were incorrectly set. Bulwer guessed that either the rain or the thinner mountain air, or both, had made the fault critical. It took a while to adjust the points, but finally the engine fired. Cold and wet and tired, the 4 men got back into the old car, and Bulwer drove on. The countryside grew more desolate as they traveled east. No towns, no houses, no livestock, nothing. The road became even worse. It reminded Bulwer of a trail in the cowboy movie. Soon the rain turned to snow and the road became icy. Bulwer kept glancing over the sheer drop at the side.
If you go off this sucker, he said to himself, you ain't going to get hurt. You're going to die.
Near Bingöl, halfway to their destination, they climbed up out of the storm. The sky was clear and there was a bright moon, almost like daylight. Bulwer could see the snow clouds and the flashing lightning in the valleys below. The mountainside was frozen white and the road was like a bobsled run. Bulwer thought,
man, I'm going to die up here. And nobody's even going to know it because they don't know where I am.
Suddenly, the steering wheel bucked in his hands and the car slowed. Bulwer had a moment of panic, thinking he was losing control, then realized he had a flat tire. He brought the car gently to a halt. They all got out and the cab driver opened the trunk. He hauled out the extra fuel tank to get at the spare wheel. Bulwer was freezing. The temperature had to be way below zero. The cabbie refused any help and insisted on changing the wheel himself. Bulwer took off his gloves and offered them to the cabbie. The man shook his head.
Pride, I guess, thought Bulwer.
By the time the job was done, it was 4 a.m. Bulwer said,
Ask him if he wants to take over the driving. I'm bushed.
The driver agreed. Bulwer got into the back. The car pulled away. Bulwer closed his eyes and tried to ignore the bumps and jerks.
He wondered whether he would reach the border in time. Shit, he thought. Nobody could say we didn't try.
A few seconds later, he was asleep.
The dirty team blew out of Tehran like a breeze. The city looked like a battlefield from which everyone had gone home. Statues had been pulled down, cars burned, and trees felled to make roadblocks. Then the roadblocks had been cleared. The cars pushed to the curb, the statues smashed, the trees burned. Some of those trees had been hand-watered every day for 50 years. But there was no fighting. They saw very few people and little traffic. Perhaps the revolution was over, or perhaps the revolutionaries were having tea. They drove past the airport and took the highway north, following the route Coburn and Simons had taken on their reconnaissance trip. Some of Simons' plans had come to nothing, but not this one. Still, Coburn was apprehensive. What was ahead of them? Did armies rage and storm in towns and hamlets still, or was the revolution done? Perhaps the villagers had returned to their sheep and their plows. Soon the two Range Rovers were bowling along at 70 miles an hour at the foot of the mountain range. On their left was a flat plain, on their right steep green hillsides topped by snowy mountain peaks against the blue sky. Coburn looked at the car in front and saw Taylor taking photographs through the tailgate window with his Instamatic. Look at Taylor, he said. What does he think this is, said Gayden, a package tour? Coburn began to feel optimistic. There had been no trouble so far. Maybe the whole country was calming down. Anyway, why should Iranians give them a hard time? What was wrong with foreigners leaving the country? Paul and Bill had false passports and were being hunted by the authorities. That was what was wrong. 30 miles from Tehran, just outside the town of Karaj, they came to their first roadblock. It was manned, as they usually were, by machine-gun-toting men and boys in ragged clothes. The lead car stopped, and Rashid jumped out even before Paul had brought the second car to a halt, making sure that he, rather than the Americans, would do the talking. He immediately began speaking in loud and rapid Farsi, with many gestures. Paul wound down the window. From what they could understand, it seemed Rashid was not giving the agreed story. He was saying something about journalists. After a while, Rashid told them all to get out of their cars. They want to search us for weapons. Coburn, remembering how many times he had been frisked on the reconnaissance trip, had concealed his little Gerber knife in the Range Rover. The Iranians patted them down, then perfunctorily searched the cars. They did not find Coburn's knife, nor did they come across the money. A few minutes later, Rashid said, We can go. 100 yards down the road was a filling station. They pulled in. Simons wanted to keep the fuel tanks as full as possible. While the cars were being fueled, Taylor produced a bottle of cognac, and they all took a swig, except Simons, who disapproved, and Rashid, whose beliefs forbade him to take alcohol. Simons was mad at Rashid. Instead of saying the group were businessmen trying to go home, Rashid had said they were journalists going to cover the fighting in Tabriz. Stick to the goddamn story, Simons said. Sure, said Rashid. Coburn thought Rashid would probably continue to say the first thing that came into his head at the time. That was how he operated. A small crowd gathered at the filling station, watching the foreigners. Coburn looked at the bystanders nervously. They were not exactly hostile, but there was something vaguely menacing about their quiet surveillance. Rashid bought a can of oil. What now? He took the fuel can, which contained most of the money in weighted plastic bags, out of the back of the car and poured oil into it to conceal the money. It was not a bad idea, Coburn thought, but I would have mentioned it to Simons before doing it. He tried to read the expressions on the faces in the crowd. Were they idly curious, resentful, suspicious, malevolent? He could not tell, but he wanted to get away. Rashid paid the bill, and the two cars pulled slowly out of the filling station. They had a clear run for the next 70 miles. The road, the new Iranian state highway, was in good condition. It ran through a valley, alongside a single-track railroad with snow-capped mountains above. The sun was shining. The second roadblock was outside Ghazvin. It was an unofficial one. The guards were not in uniform, but it was bigger and more organized than the last. There were two checkpoints, one after another, and a line of cars waiting. The two Range Rovers joined the queue. The car in front of them was searched methodically. A guard opened the trunk and took out what looked like a rolled-up sheet. He unrolled it and found a rifle. He shouted something and waved the rifle in the air. Other guards came running. A crowd gathered. The driver of the car was questioned. One of the guards knocked him to the ground. Rashid pulled his car out of the line. Coburn told Paul to follow. What's he doing? Gayden said. Rashid inched through the crowd. The people made way as the Range Rover nudged them. They were interested in the man with the rifle. Paul kept the second Range Rover right on the tail of the first. They passed the first checkpoint. What the fuck is he doing? Said Gayden. This is asking for trouble, said Coburn. They approached the second checkpoint. Without stopping, Rashid yelled at the guard through the window. The guard said something in reply. Rashid accelerated. Paul followed. Coburn breathed a sigh of relief. That was just like Rashid. He did the unexpected, on impulse, without thinking through the consequences, and somehow he always got away with it. It just made life a little tense for the people with him. Next time they stopped, Rashid explained that he had simply told the guard the two Range Rovers had been cleared at the first checkpoint. At the next roadblock, Rashid persuaded the guards to write a pass on his windshield in magic marker, and they were waved through another three roadblocks without being searched. Keen Taylor was driving the lead car when, climbing a long, winding hill, they saw two heavy trucks, side by side, filling the whole width of the road, coming downhill fast toward them. Taylor swerved off the road and bumped to a halt in the ditch, and Paul followed. The trucks went by, still side by side, and everyone said what a lousy driver Taylor was. At midday, they took a break. They parked at the roadside near a ski lift and lunched on dry crackers and cupcakes. Although there was snow on the mountainside, the sun was shining and they were not cold. Taylor got out his bottle of cognac, but it had leaked and was empty. Coburn suspected that Simons had surreptitiously loosened the cork. They drank water. They passed through the small, neat town of San Juan, where on the reconnaissance trip, Coburn and Simons had talked to the chief of police. Just beyond San Juan, the Iranian State Highway ended, rather abruptly. In the second car, Coburn saw Rashid's Range Rover suddenly disappear from view. Paul slammed on the brakes and they got out to look. Where the tarmac ended, Rashid had gone down a steep slope for about 8 feet and landed nose down in mud. Off to the right, their route continued up an unpaved mountain road. Rashid restarted the stalled engine and put the car into four-wheel drive and reverse gear. Slowly he inched back up the bank and onto the road. The Range Rover was covered with mud. Rashid turned on the wipers and washed the windshield. When the mud splashes were gone, so was the pass that had been written on with magic marker. Rashid could have rewritten it, but nobody had a magic marker. They drove west, heading for the southern tip of Lake Rezaie. The Range Rovers were built for rough roads, and they could still do 40 miles an hour. They were climbing all the time. The temperature dropped steadily, and the countryside was covered with snow, but the road was clear. Coburn wondered whether they might even make the border tonight instead of tomorrow as planned. Gaydon, in the back seat, leaned forward and said, "Nobody's going to believe it was this easy. We better make up some war stories to tell when we get home." He spoke too soon. As daylight faded, they approached Mahabad. Its outskirts were marked by a few scattered huts made of wood and mud brick along the sides of the winding road. The two Range Rovers swept around a bend and pulled up sharply. The road was blocked by a parked truck and a large but apparently disciplined crowd. The men were wearing the traditional baggy trousers, black vest, red and white checkered headdress, and bandolier of Kurdish tribesmen. Rashid jumped out of the lead car and went into his act. Coburn studied the guns of the guards and saw both Russian and American automatic weapons. "Everyone out of the cars," said Rashid. By now it was routine. One by one they were searched. This time the search was a little more thorough, and they found Keen Taylor's little switchblade knife, but they let him keep it. They did not find Coburn's knife or the money. Coburn waited for Rashid to say, "We can go." It was taking longer than usual. Rashid argued with the Kurds for a few minutes, then said, "We have to go and see the headman of the town." They got back into the cars. A Kurd with a rifle joined them in each car and directed them into the little town. They were ordered to stop outside a small whitewashed building. One of the guards went in, came out again a minute later, and got back into the car without explanation. They stopped again outside what was clearly a hospital. Here they picked up a passenger, a young Iranian in a suit. Coburn wondered what the hell was going on. Finally, they drove down an alley and parked outside what looked like a small private house. They went inside. Rashid told them to take off their shoes. Gaydon had several $1,000s in $100 bills in his shoes. As he took them off, he frantically stuffed the money into the toes of his shoes. They were ushered into a large room, furnished with nothing but a beautiful Persian carpet. Simons quietly told everyone where to sit. Leaving a space in the circle for the Iranians, he put Rashid on the right of the space. Next to Rashid was Taylor, then Coburn, then Simons himself opposite the space. On Simons' right, Paul and Bill sat, back a little from the line of the circle where they would be least conspicuous. Gaydon, completing the circle, sat on Bill's right. As Taylor sat down, he saw that he had a big hole in the toe of his sock, and $100 bills were poking through the hole. He cursed under his breath and hastily pushed the money back toward his heel. The young man in the suit followed them in. He seemed educated and spoke good English. "You are about to meet a man who has just escaped after 25 years in jail," he said. Bill almost said, "Well, how about that? I've just escaped from jail myself." But he stopped himself just in time. "You are to be put on trial, and this man will be your judge," the young Iranian went on. The words "on trial" hit Paul like a blow, and he thought, "We've come all this way for nothing."
The clean team spent Wednesday at Lugolz's house in Tehran.
Early in the morning, a call came through from Tom Walter in Dallas. The line was poor and the conversation confused, but Joe Poche was able to tell Walter that he and the clean team were safe, would move into the embassy as soon as possible, and would leave the country whenever the embassy got the evacuation flights finally organized. Poche also reported that Kathy Gallagher's condition had not improved, and she had been taken to the hospital the previous evening. John Howell called Abu Hassan, who had another message from Dadgar. Dadgar was willing to negotiate a lower bail. If EDS located Paul and Bill, the company should turn them in and post the lower bail. The Americans should realize that it would be hopeless for Paul and Bill to try to leave Iran by regular means and very dangerous for them to leave otherwise. Howell took that to mean that Paul and Bill would not have been allowed to get out on an embassy evacuation flight. He wondered again whether the clean team might be in more danger than the dirty team. Bob Young felt the same. While they were discussing it, they heard shooting. It seemed to be coming from the direction of the U.S. Embassy. The National Voice of Iran, a radio station broadcasting from Baku across the border in the Soviet Union, had for several days been issuing news bulletins about clandestine American plans for a counter-revolution. On Wednesday, the National Voice announced that the files of Savak, the Shah's hated secret police force, had been transferred to the U.S. Embassy. The story was almost certainly invented, but it was highly plausible. The CIA had created Savak and was in close contact with it, and everyone knew that U.S. embassies, like all embassies, were full of spies thinly disguised as diplomatic attachés. Anyway, some of the revolutionaries in Tehran believed the story and, without consulting any of the Ayatollah's aides, decided to take action. During the morning, they entered the high building surrounding the embassy compound and took up position with automatic weapons. They opened fire at 10:30. Ambassador William Sullivan was in his outer office, taking a call at his secretary's desk. He was speaking to the Ayatollah's deputy foreign minister. President Carter had decided to recognize the new revolutionary government in Iran, and Sullivan was making arrangements to deliver an official note. When he put the phone down, he turned around to see his press attaché, Barry Rosen, standing there with two American journalists. Sullivan was furious, for the White House had given specific instructions that the decision to recognize the new government was to be announced in Washington, not Tehran. Sullivan took Rosen into the inner office and chewed him out. Rosen told him that the two journalists were there to make arrangements for the body of Joe Alex Morris, the Los Angeles Times correspondent who had been shot during the fighting at Doshan Tope. Sullivan, feeling foolish, told Rosen to ask the journalists not to reveal what they had learned in overhearing Sullivan on the phone. Rosen went out. Sullivan's phone rang. He picked it up. There was a sudden, tremendous crash of gunfire, and a hail of bullets shattered his windows. Sullivan hit the floor. He slithered across the room and into the next office, where he came nose to nose with his deputy, Charlie Nass, who had been holding a meeting about the evacuation flights. Sullivan had two phone numbers that he could use in an emergency to reach revolutionary leaders. He now told Nass to call one and the army attaché to call the other. Still lying on the floor, the two men pulled telephones off a desk and started dialing. Sullivan took out his walkie-talkie and called for reports from the Marine units in the compound. The machine gun attack had been covering fire for a squad of about 75 revolutionaries who had come over the front wall of the embassy compound and were now advancing on the ambassadorial residence. Fortunately, most of the staff were with Sullivan in the Chancery building. Sullivan ordered the Marines to fall back, not to use their rifles, and to fire their sidearms only in self-defense. Then he crawled out of the executive suite and into the corridor. During the next hour, as the attackers took the residence and the cafeteria building, Sullivan got all the civilians in the chancery herded into the communications vault upstairs. When he heard the attackers breaking down the steel doors of the building, he ordered the Marines inside to join the civilians in the vault. There he made them pile their weapons in a corner and ordered everyone to surrender as soon as possible. Eventually, Sullivan himself went into the vault, leaving the army attaché and an interpreter outside. When the attackers reached the second floor, Sullivan opened the vault door and walked out with his hands over his head. The others, about 100 people, followed him. They were all herded into the waiting room of the executive suite and frisked. There was a confused dispute between two factions of Iranians, and Sullivan realized that the Ayatollah's people had sent a rescue force, presumably in response to the phone calls by Charlie Nass and the army attaché, and the rescuers had arrived on the second floor at the same time as the attackers. Suddenly, a shot came through the window. All the Americans dropped to the floor. One of the Iranians seemed to think the shot had come from within the room, and he swung his AK-47 rifle wildly at the tangle of prisoners on the floor. Then Barry Rosen, the press attaché, yelled in Farsi, "It came from outside! It came from outside!" At that moment, Sullivan found himself lying next to the two journalists who had been in his outer office. "I hope you're getting all this down in your notebooks," he said. Eventually, they were taken out into the courtyard, where Ibrahim Yazdi, the Ayatollah's new deputy prime minister, apologized to Sullivan for the attack. Yazdi also gave Sullivan a personal escort, a group of students who would henceforth be responsible for the safety of the U.S. ambassador. The leader of the group explained to Sullivan that they were well qualified to guard him. They had studied him and were familiar with his routine, for until recently, their assignment had been to assassinate him. Late that afternoon, Kathy Gallagher called from the hospital. She had been given some medication that solved her problem, at least temporarily, and she wanted to rejoin her husband and the others at Lou Goltz's house. Joe Poche did not want any more of the clean team to leave the house, but he also did not want any Iranians to know where they were. So he called Kolam and asked him to pick up Kathy at the hospital and bring her to the corner of the street where her husband would meet her. She arrived at around 7:30 that evening. She was feeling better, but Kolam had told her a horrifying story. "They shot up our hotel rooms yesterday," she said. Kolam had gone to the Hyatt to pay EDS's bill and pick up the suitcases they had left behind, Kathy explained. The rooms had been wrecked, there were bullet holes everywhere, and the luggage had been slashed to ribbons. "Just our rooms?" Howell asked. "Yes." "Did he find out how it happened?" When Kolam went to pay the bill, the hotel manager had said to him, "Who the hell were those people? The CIA?" Apparently, on Monday morning, shortly after all the EDS people left the hotel, the revolutionaries had taken it over. They had harassed all the Americans, demanding their passports, and had shown pictures of two men whom they were seeking. The manager had not recognized the men in the photographs, nor had anyone else. Howell wondered what had so enraged the revolutionaries that they had smashed up the rooms. Perhaps Gaydon's well-stocked bar offended their Muslim sensibilities. Also left behind in Gaydon's suite were a tape recorder used for dictation, some suction microphones for taping phone conversations, and a child's walkie-talkie set. The revolutionaries might have thought this was CIA surveillance gear. Throughout the day, vague and alarming reports of what was happening at the embassy reached Howell and the clean team through Goltz's houseman, who was calling friends. But Goltz returned as the others were having dinner, and after a couple of stiff drinks, he was none the worse for his experience. He had spent a good deal of time lying on his ample belly in a corridor. The next day, he went back to his desk, and he came home that evening with good news. Evacuation flights would start on Saturday, and the clean team would be on the first. Howell thought, Dadgar may have other ideas about that.
In Istanbul, Ross Perot had a dreadful feeling that the whole operation was slipping out of control. He heard via Dallas that the U.S. embassy in Tehran had been overrun by revolutionaries. He also knew, because Tom Walter had talked to Joe Poche earlier, that the clean team had been planning to move into the embassy compound as soon as possible. But after the attack on the embassy, almost all telephone lines to Tehran had been disconnected, and the White House was monopolizing the few lines left. So Perot did not know whether the clean team had been in the embassy at the time of the attack, nor did he know what kind of danger they might be in even if they were still at Goltz's house. The loss of phone contact also meant that Merv Stauffer could not call Kolam to find out whether the dirty team had sent a message for Jim Neifler, saying either that they were okay or that they were in trouble. The whole seventh-floor crew in Dallas was at work pulling strings to get one of the few remaining lines so they could talk to Kolam. Tom Walter had gone on to AT&T and spoken to Ray Johnson, who handled the EDS phone account. It was a very big account. EDS's computers in different parts of the USA talked to one another along telephone lines, and Johnson had been keen to help a major customer. He had asked whether EDS's call to Tehran was a matter of life and death. "You bet it is," said Tom Walter. Johnson was trying to get them a line. At the same time, T.J. Marquez was sweet-talking an international operator, trying to persuade her to break the rules. Perot had also lost touch with Ralph Bulwer, who was supposed to meet the dirty team on the Turkish side of the border. Bulwer had last been heard from in Adana, 500 miles from where he was supposed to be. Perot presumed he was now on his way to the rendezvous, but there was no way of telling how far he had got or whether he would make it on time. Perot had spent most of the day trying to get a light plane or a helicopter with which to fly into Iran. The Boeing 707 was no use for that, because Perot would need to fly low and search for the Range Rovers with X or A on their roofs, then land on tiny, disused airfields, or even on a road or in a meadow. But so far his efforts had only confirmed what Bulwer had told him at 6 o'clock that morning. It was not going to happen. In desperation, Perot had called a friend in the Drug Enforcement Agency and asked for the phone number of the agency's man in Turkey, thinking that narcotics people would surely know how to get hold of light planes. The DEA man had come to the Sheraton, accompanied by another man who, Perot gathered, was with the CIA. But if they knew where to get a plane, they weren't telling. In Dallas, Merv Stauffer was calling all over Europe, looking for a suitable aircraft that could be bought or rented immediately and flown into Turkey. He, too, had failed so far. Late in the afternoon, Perot had said to Pat Scully, "I want to talk to the highest-ranking American in Istanbul." Scully had gone off and raised a little hell at the American consulate, and now at 10:30 p.m., a consul was sitting in Perot's suite at the Sheraton. Perot was leveling with him. "My men aren't criminals of any kind," he said. "They're ordinary businessmen who have wives and children worrying themselves to death back home. The Iranians kept them in jail for 6 weeks without bringing any charges or finding any evidence against them. Now they're free and they're trying to get out of the country. If they're caught, you can imagine how much chance they'd have of justice. None at all. The way things are in Iran now, my men may not get as far as the border. I want to go in and get them, and that's where I need your help. I have to borrow, rent, or buy a small aircraft. Now, can you help me?" "No," said the consul. "In this country, it's against the law for private individuals to have aircraft. Because it's against the law, the planes aren't here even for someone who's prepared to break the law. But you must have aircraft. The State Department has no aircraft." Perot despaired. Was he to sit and do nothing to help the dirty team? The consul said, "Mr. Perot, we're here to help American citizens, and I'm going to try to get you an aircraft. I'll pull whatever strings I can. But I'll tell you now that my chance of success is close to zero." "Well, I appreciate it." The consul got up to go. Perot said, "It's very important that my presence in Turkey be kept secret. Right now, the Iranian authorities have no idea where my men are. If they should learn that I'm here, they will be able to figure out how my men are getting out, and that would be a catastrophe. So please be very discreet." "I understand." The consul left. A few minutes later, the phone rang. It was T.J. Marquez calling from Dallas. "Perot, you're on the front page of the paper today." Perot's heart sank. The story was out. T.J. said, "The governor just appointed you chairman of the drug commission." Perot breathed again. "Marquez, you scared me." T.J. laughed. "You shouldn't do that to an old man," Perot said. "Boy, you really caught my attention there." "Oh, wait a minute. Margo's on the other line," said T.J. "She just wants to wish you a happy Valentine's Day." Perot realized it was February 14th. He said, "Tell her I'm completely safe and being guarded at all times by two blondes." "Wait a minute, I'll tell her." T.J. came back on the line a minute later, laughing. "She says, isn't it interesting that you need two to replace her?" Perot chuckled. He'd walked into that one. He should have known better than to try to score points off Margot. "Now, did you get through to Tehran?" "Yes, the international operator got us a line, and we blew it on a wrong number. Then AT&T got us a line, and we reached Golham." "And?" "Nothing. He hasn't heard from them." Perot's temporary cheerfulness vanished. "What did you ask him?" "We just said, are there any messages? And he said there weren't." "Damn." Perot almost wished the dirty team had called to say they were in trouble, for then at least he would have known their location. He said goodbye to T.J. and got ready for bed. He had lost the clean team, he had lost Boulware, and now he had lost the dirty team. He'd failed to get hold of an aircraft and wished to go looking for them. The whole operation was a mess, and there was not a thing he could do about it. The suspense was killing him. He realized that never in his life had he experienced this much tension. He had seen men crumble under stress, but he had never really been able to relate to their suffering because it had never happened to him. Stress did not upset him, normally. In fact, he thrived on it. But this was different. He broke his own rule and allowed himself to think about all the bad things that could happen. What was at stake here was his freedom, for if this rescue were to go wrong, he would end up in jail. Already, he had assembled a mercenary army, connived at the misuse of American passports, arranged the forgery of U.S. military identity cards, and conspired to effect an illegal border crossing. He hoped he would go to jail in the U.S. rather than in Turkey. The worst would be if the Turks sent him to Iran to be tried for his crimes there. He lay awake in his hotel bed, worrying about the clean team, about the dirty team, about Boulware, and about himself. There was nothing he could do but endure it. In the future, he would be more sympathetic to the men he put under stress, if he had a future.
Coburn was tense, watching Simons. They all sat in a circle on the Persian carpet, waiting for the judge. Simons had told Coburn before they left Tehran, "Keep your eye on me." So far, Simons had been passive, rolling with the punches, letting Rashid do the talking, allowing the team to be arrested. But there might come a moment when he changed his tactics. If he decided to start a fight, he would let Coburn know a split second before it happened. The judge arrived. Aged about 50, he wore a dark blue jacket with a light tan sweater underneath and an open-neck shirt. He had the air of a professional man, a doctor or a lawyer. He had a .45 stuck in his belt. Rashid recognized him. His name was Habib Bulurian, and he was a leading communist. Bulurian sat in the space Simons had intended for him. He said something in Farsi, and the young man in the suit, who now took on the role of interpreter, asked for their passports. This is it, Coburn thought. This is where we get into trouble. He will look at Bill's passport and realize it belongs to someone else. The passports were piled up on the carpet in front of Bulurian. He looked at the top one. The interpreter began to write down details. There was some confusion about surnames and given names. Iranians often got the two mixed up for some reason. Rashid was handing the passports to Balurian, and Gaydon was leaning over and pointing out things. And it dawned on Coburn that between the two, they were making the confusion worse. Rashid was giving Balurian the same passport more than once, and Gaydon, in leaning over to point out things in a passport, was covering up the photograph. Coburn admired their nerve. In the end, the passports were handed back, and it seemed to Coburn that bills had never actually been opened. Balurian began to interrogate Rashid in Farsi. Rashid seemed to be telling the official cover story about there being ordinary American businessmen trying to go home, with some embellishments about family members on the point of death back in the States. Eventually, the interpreter said in English, "Would you tell us exactly what you're doing here?" Rashid said, "Well, you see..." Then a guard behind him slammed in the bolt of his machine gun and stuck the barrel into the back of Rashid's neck. Rashid fell silent. Clearly, the interpreter wanted to hear what the Americans had to say, to see whether their story matched Rashid's. The guard's action was a brutal reminder that they were in the power of violent revolutionaries. Gaydon, as the senior EDS executive there, replied to the interpreter. "We all work for a data processing company called PARS Data System, or PDS," he said. In fact, PDS was the Iranian company jointly owned by EDS and Abulfath Mahavi. Gaydon did not mention EDS because, as Simons had pointed out before they left Tehran, Dadgar might put out a blanket arrest order on anyone connected with EDS. "We had a contract with Bank Omran," Gaydon went on, telling the truth, but by no means the whole truth. "We weren't getting paid, people were throwing rocks at our window, we had no money, we missed our families, and we just wanted to go home. The airport was closed, so we decided to drive." "That's right," said the interpreter. "The same thing happened to me. I wanted to fly to Europe, but the airport was closed." We may have an ally here, Coburn thought. Balurian asked, and the interpreter translated, "Did you have a contract with Isaran?" Coburn was astonished. For someone who had spent 25 years in jail, Balurian was remarkably well-informed. Isaran, Information Systems Iran, was a data processing company that had once been owned by Abulfath Mahavi and had subsequently been bought by the government. The company was widely believed to have close links with the secret police, SAVAK. Worse, EDS did have a contract with Isaran. In partnership, the two companies had created a document control system for the Iranian Navy back in 1977. "We have absolutely nothing to do with Isaran," Gaydon lied. "Can you give us some proof of whom you work for?" That was a problem. Before leaving Tehran, they all had destroyed any papers connected with EDS under Simon's instructions. Now they all searched their pockets for anything they might have overlooked. Keen Taylor found his health insurance card with Electronic Data Systems Corporation printed across the bottom. He handed it to the interpreter, saying, "Electronic Data Systems is the parent company of PDS. Balurian got up and left the room. The interpreter, the armed Kurds, and the EDS men waited in silence. Coburn thought, what now? Could Balurian possibly know that EDS had once had a contract with Isaran? If so, would he jump to the conclusion that the EDS men were connected with SAVAK? Or had his question about Isaran been a shot in the dark? In that case, had he believed their story about being ordinary businessmen trying to go home? Opposite Coburn, on the far side of the circle, Bill was feeling strangely at peace. He had peaked out on fear during the questioning, and he was simply incapable of worrying any longer. "We've tried our hardest to get out," he thought, "and if they put us up against the wall right now and shoot us, so be it." Balurian walked back in, loading a gun. Coburn glanced at Simons. His eyes were riveted on the gun. It was an old M1 carbine that looked as if it dated from World War II. "He can't shoot us all with that," Coburn thought. Balurian handed the gun to the interpreter and said something in Farsi. Coburn gathered his muscles to spring. There would be a hell of a mess if they opened fire in this room. The interpreter took the gun and said, "And now you will be our guests and drink tea." Balurian wrote on a piece of paper and handed it to the interpreter. Coburn realized that Balurian had simply issued the gun to the interpreter and given him a permit to carry it. "Christ, I thought he was going to shoot us," Coburn muttered. Simon's face was expressionless. Tea was served. It was now dark outside. Rashid asked whether there was somewhere the Americans could spend the night. "You will be our guests," said the interpreter. "I will personally look after you." Coburn thought, for that he needs a gun? The interpreter went on, "In the morning our mullah will write a note to the mullah of Rezaeh, asking him to let you pass." Coburn murmured to Simons, "What do you think? Should we stay the night here or go on?" "I don't think we have a choice," Simon said. When he said guests, he was just being polite. They drank their tea, and the interpreter said, "Now we will go and have dinner." They got up and put on their shoes. Walking out to the cars, Coburn noticed that Gaydon was limping. "What's the matter with your feet?" he said. "Not so loud," Gaydon hissed. "I got all the money stuffed up in the toes of my shoes, and my feet are killing me." Coburn laughed. They got into the cars and drove off, still accompanied by Kurdish guards and the interpreter. Gaydon surreptitiously eased off his shoes and rearranged the money. They pulled into a filling station. Gaydon murmured, "If they weren't going to let us go, they wouldn't take us to gas up, would they?" Coburn shrugged. They drove to the town restaurant. The EDS men sat down, and the guards sat at tables around them, forming a rough circle and cutting them off from the townspeople. A TV set was on, and the Ayatollah was making a speech. Paul thought, Jesus, it had to be now when we're in trouble that this guy comes to power. Then the interpreter told him that Khomeini was saying Americans should not be molested, but should be allowed to leave Iran unharmed, and Paul felt better. They were served cello kebab, lamb and rice. The guards ate heartily, their rifles on the table beside their plates. Keen Taylor ate a little rice, then put down his spoon. He had a headache. He had been sharing the driving with Rashid, and he felt as if the sun had been in his eyes all day. He was also worried, for it occurred to him that Balurian might call Tehran during the night to check out EDS. The guards kept telling him with gestures to eat, but he sat and nursed a Coke. Coburn was not hungry either. He had recalled that he was supposed to phone Golam. It was late. They would be worried sick in Dallas. But what should he tell Golam? That they were okay, or that they were in trouble? There was some discussion about who should pay the bill when the meal was over. The guards wanted to pay, Rashid said. The Americans were anxious not to offend by offering to pay when they were supposed to be guests, but also keen to ingratiate themselves with these people. In the end, Keen Taylor paid for everyone. As they were leaving, Coburn said to the interpreter, I'd sure like to call Tehran to let our people know we're all right. Okay, said the young man. They drove to the post office. Coburn and the interpreter went in. There was a crowd of people waiting to use the 3 or 4 phone booths. The interpreter spoke to someone behind the counter, then told Coburn, All the lines to Tehran are busy. It's very difficult to get through. Could we come back later? Okay. They drove out of the town in the dark. After a few minutes, they stopped at a gate in a fence. The moonlight showed the distant outline of what might have been a dam. There was a long delay while keys to the gate were found, then they drove in. They found themselves in a small park surrounding an ornate, modern 2-story building made of white granite. This is one of the Shah's palaces, the interpreter explained. He has used it only once, when he opened the power station. Tonight we will use it. They went inside. The place was cozily warm. The interpreter said indignantly, The heating has been on for 3 years, just in case the Shah should decide to drop by. They all went upstairs and looked at their quarters. There was a luxurious royal suite with an enormous fancy bathroom. Then along the corridor were smaller rooms, each containing 2 single beds and a bathroom, presumably for the Shah's bodyguard. Under each bed was a pair of slippers. The Americans moved into the guards' rooms, and the revolutionary Kurds took over the Shah's suite. One of them decided to take a bath. The Americans could hear him splashing about, hooting and hollering. After a while, he came out. He was the biggest and burliest of them, and he had put on one of the Shah's fancy bathrobes. The Americans moved into the guards' rooms, and the revolutionary Kurds took over the Shah's suite. One of them decided to take a bath. The Americans could hear him splashing about, hooting and hollering. After a while, he came out. He was the biggest and burliest of them, and he had put on one of the Shah's fancy bathrobes. He came mincing down the corridor while his colleagues fell about laughing. He went up to Gaydon and said in heavily accented English, Complete gentlemen! Gaydon broke up. Coburn said to Simons, What's the routine for tomorrow? They want to escort us to Rezaieh and hand us over to the head man there, Simon said. It'll help to have them with us if we meet any more roadblocks. But when we get to Rezaieh, we may be able to persuade them to take us to the professor's house instead of the head man. Coburn nodded, Okay. Rashid looked worried. These are bad people, he whispered. Don't trust them. We got to get out of here. Coburn was not sure he trusted the Kurds, but he was quite certain there would be trouble if the Americans tried to leave now. He noticed that one of the guards had a G3 rifle. Hey, that's a real neat firearm, he said. The guard smiled and seemed to understand. I've never seen one before, Coburn said. How do you load it? Load so, said the guard and showed him. They sat down, and the guard explained the rifle. He spoke enough English to make himself understood with the help of gestures. After a while, Coburn realized that he was now holding the rifle. He started to relax. The others wanted to take showers, but Gaydon went first and used all the hot water. Paul took a cold shower. He had sure as hell got used to cold showers lately. They learned a little about their interpreter. He was studying in Europe and had been home on holiday when the revolution caught him and prevented his going back. That was how come he knew the airport was closed. At midnight, Coburn asked him, Can we try to place that call again? Okay. One of the guards escorted Coburn back into town. They went to the post office, which was still open. However, there were no lines to Tehran. Coburn waited until 2 o'clock in the morning, then gave up. When he returned to the palace beside the dam, everyone was fast asleep. He went to bed. At least they were all still alive. That was enough to be thankful for. Nobody knew what was between them and the border. He would worry about that tomorrow. Chapter 12
Wake up, Coburn. Let's move. Let's go.
Simon's gravelly voice penetrated Coburn's slumber, and he opened his eyes, thinking, Where am I? In the Shah's palace at Mahabad. Oh, shit. He got up. Simons was getting the dirty team ready to go, but there was no sign of their guards. Apparently, they were all still asleep. The Americans made plenty of noise, and eventually the Kurds emerged from the royal suite. Simon said to Rashid, "Tell them we have to go. We're in a hurry. Our friends are waiting at the border for us." Rashid told them, then said, "We have to wait." Simons did not like this. "What for?" "They all want to take showers." Keen Taylor said, "I don't see the urgency. Most of them haven't taken a shower in a year or two. You'd think they could wait another day." Simons contained his impatience for half an hour, then told Rashid to tell the guards again that the team had to hurry. "We have to see the Shah's bathroom," Rashid said. "God damn it, we've seen it," said Simons. "What's the delay?" Everyone trooped into the royal suite and dutifully exclaimed at the shameful luxury of an unused palace. And still the guards would not move out. Coburn wondered what was happening. Had they changed their minds about escorting the Americans to the next town? Had Bullurian checked up on EDS during the night? Simons would not be kept here much longer. Finally, the young interpreter showed up, and it turned out the guards had been waiting for him. The plan was unchanged. A group of Kurds would go with the Americans on the next leg of their journey. Simon said, "We have friends in Rezaie. We'd like to be taken to their house, rather than go see the head man of the town." "It's not safe," said the interpreter. "The fighting is heavy north of here. The city of Tabriz is still in the hands of the Shah's supporters. I must hand you over to the people who can protect you." "All right, but can we leave now?" "Sure." They left. They drove into the town and were ordered to stop outside a house. The interpreter went in. They all waited. Somebody brought bread and cream cheese for breakfast. Coburn got out of his car and went to Simon's. "What's happening now?" "This is the Mullah's house," Rashid explained. "He is writing a letter to the Mullah of Rezaie about us." It was about an hour before the interpreter came out with a promised letter. Next, they drove to the police station. And there they saw their escort vehicle, a big white ambulance with a flashing red light on top, its windows knocked out, and some kind of identification scrawled on its side in Farsi with red magic marker, presumably saying, "Mahabad Revolutionary Committee," or something similar. It was full of gun-toting Kurds. So much for traveling inconspicuously. At last, they got on the road, the ambulance leading the way. Simons was anxious about Dadgar. Clearly, no one in Mahabad had been alerted to look out for Paul and Bill, but Rezaie was a much bigger town. Simons did not know whether Dadgar's authority extended into the countryside. All he knew was that so far, Dadgar had always surprised everyone by his dedication and his ability to persist through changes of government. Simons wished the team did not have to be taken before Rezaie authorities. "We have good friends in Rezaie," he told the young interpreter. "If you could take us to their house, we'd be very safe there." "Oh, no," said the interpreter. "If I disobey orders, you get hurt. There will be hell to pay." Simons gave up. It was clear they were as much prisoners as guests of the Kurds. The revolution in Mahabad was characterized by communist discipline rather than Islamic anarchy, and the only way to get rid of the escort would be by violence. Simons was not yet ready to start a fight. Just outside the town, the ambulance pulled off the road and stopped at a little cafe. "Why are we stopping?" Simon said. "Breakfast," said the interpreter. "We don't need breakfast," Simon said forcefully. "But we don't need breakfast." The interpreter shrugged and shouted something to the Kurds getting out of the ambulance. They got back in, and the convoy drove on. They reached the outskirts of Rezaie late in the morning. Their way was barred by the inevitable roadblock. This one was a serious military-style affair of parked vehicles, sandbags, and barbed wire. The convoy slowed, and an armed guard waved them off the road into the forecourt of a filling station that had been turned into a command post. The approach road was well covered by machine guns in the filling station building. The ambulance failed to stop soon enough and ran right into the barbed wire fence. The two Range Rovers pulled up in an orderly fashion. The ambulance was immediately surrounded by guards, and an argument started. Rashid and the interpreter went over to join in. The Rezaie revolutionaries did not automatically assume that the Mahabad revolutionaries were on their side. The Rezaie men were Azerbaijanis, not Kurds, and the argument took place in Turkish as well as Farsi. The Kurds were being ordered to turn in their weapons, it seemed, and they were refusing angrily. The interpreter was showing the note from the Mahabad mullah. Nobody was taking much notice of Rashid, who was suddenly an outsider. Eventually, the interpreter and Rashid came back to the cars. "We are going to take you to a hotel," said the interpreter. "Then I will go and see the mullah." The ambulance was all tangled up in the barbed wire fence and had to be extricated before they could go. Guards from the roadblock escorted them into the town. It was a large town by the standards of the Iranian provinces. It had plenty of concrete and stone buildings and a few paved roads. The convoy pulled up in a main street. Distant shouting could be heard. Rashid and the interpreter went into a building, presumably a hotel, and the others waited. Coburn felt optimistic. You didn't put prisoners into a hotel before shooting them. This was just administrative hassle. The distant shouting grew louder, and a crowd appeared at the end of the street. In the rear car, Coburn said, "What the hell is this?" The Kurds jumped out of their ambulance and surrounded the two Range Rovers, forming a wedge in front of the lead car. One of them pointed to Coburn's door and made a motion like turning a key. "Lock the doors," Coburn said to the others. The crowd came closer. It was some kind of street parade, Coburn realized. At the head of the procession were a number of army officers in tattered uniforms. One of them was in tears. "You know what I think?" said Coburn. "The army just surrendered, and they're running the officers down Main Street." The vengeful crowd surged around the vehicles, jostling the Kurdish guards and looking through the windows with hostile glares. The Kurds stood their ground and tried to push the crowds away from the cars. It looked as though it would turn into a fight at any moment. "This is getting ugly," said Gaydon. Coburn kept an eye on the car in front, wondering what Simons would do. Coburn saw the snout of a gun aimed at the window on the driver's side. "Paul, don't look now, but someone's pointing a gun at your head." "Jesus!" Coburn could imagine what would happen next. The mob would start rocking the cars, then they would turn them over, then suddenly it ended. The defeated soldiers were the main attraction, and as they passed on, the crowd followed. Coburn relaxed. Paul said, "For a minute there." Rashid and the interpreter came out of the hotel. Rashid said, "They don't want to know about a bunch of Americans going into their hotel. They won't take the risk." Coburn took that to mean feelings were running so high in the town that the hotel could get burned by the mob for taking in foreigners. "We have to go to revolutionary headquarters." They drove on. There was feverish activity in the street. Lines of pickup trucks of all shapes and sizes were being loaded with supplies, presumably for the revolutionaries still fighting in Tabriz. The convoy stopped at what appeared to be a school. There was a huge, noisy crowd outside the courtyard, apparently waiting to get in. After an argument, the Kurds persuaded the gate sentry to admit the ambulance and the two Range Rovers. The crowd reacted angrily when the foreigners went in. Coburn breathed a sigh of relief as the courtyard gate closed behind him. They got out of the cars. The courtyard was crammed with shot-up automobiles. A mullah was standing on a stack of rifle crates, conducting a noisy and passionate ceremony with a crowd of men. Rashid said, "He is swearing in fresh troops to go to Tabriz and fight for the revolution." The guards led the Americans toward the school building on one side of the courtyard. A man came down the steps and started yelling at them angrily, pointing at the Kurds. "They must not go into the building, armed," Rashid translated. Coburn could tell the Kurds were getting jumpy. To their surprise, they found themselves in hostile territory. They produced the note from the Mahabad mullah. There was more argument. Eventually, Rashid said, "You all wait here. I'm going inside to talk to the leader of the revolutionary committee." He went up the steps and disappeared. Paul and Gaydon lit cigarettes. Paul felt scared and dejected. These people were bound to call Tehran, he felt, to find out about him. Getting sent back to jail might be the least of his worries now. He said to Gaydon, "I really appreciate what you've done for me, but it's a shame. I think we've had it." Coburn was more worried about the mob outside the gate. In here, at least, someone was trying to maintain order. Out there was a wolf pack. What if they persuaded some goofy guard to open the gate? It would be a lynch mob. In Tehran, a fellow, an Iranian who had done something to anger the crowd, had been literally pulled apart, his arms and legs torn off by people who were just crazed, hysterical. The guards jerked their weapons, indicating that the Americans should move to one side of the courtyard and stand against a wall. They obeyed, feeling vulnerable. Coburn looked at the wall. It had bullet holes in it. Paul had seen them, too, and his face was white. "My God," he said, "I think we bought the farm."
Rashid asked himself, what will be the psychology of the leader of the Revolutionary Committee? He has a million things to do, Rashid thought. He has just taken control of this town, and he has never been in power before. He must deal with the officers of the defeated army. He must round up suspected Savak agents and interrogate them. He must get the town running normally. He must guard against the counter-revolution, and he must send troops to fight in Tabriz. All he wants to do, Rashid concluded, is cross things off his list. He has no time or sympathy for fleeing Americans. If he must make a decision, he will simply throw us in jail for the time being and deal with us later, at his leisure. Therefore, I must make sure that he does not decide. Rashid was shown into a schoolroom. The leader was sitting on the floor. He was a tall, strong man with the thrill of victory in his face. But he looked exhausted, confused, and restless. Rashid's escort said in Farsi, "This man comes from Mahabad with a letter from the mullah. He has 6 Americans with him." Rashid thought of a movie he had seen in which a man got into a guarded building by flashing his driving license instead of a pass. If you had enough confidence, you could undermine people's suspicions. "No, I come from the Tehran Revolutionary Committee," Rashid said. "There are 5,000 or 6,000 Americans in Tehran, and we have decided to send them home. The airport is closed, so we will bring them all out this way. Obviously, we must make arrangements and set up procedures for handling all these people. That is why I am here. But you have many problems to deal with. Perhaps I should discuss the details with your subordinates." "Yes," said the leader, and waved them away. It was the technique of the big lie, and it had worked. "I'm the deputy leader," said Rashid's escort as they left the room. They went into another room where five or six people were drinking tea. Rashid talked to the deputy leader, loud enough for the others to hear. "These Americans just want to get home and see their families. We're happy to get rid of them, and we want to treat them right so they won't have anything against the new regime." "Why do you have Americans with you now?" the deputy asked. "For a trial run. This way, you know, we find out what the problems are." "But you don't have to let them cross the border." "Oh, yes. They are good men who have never done any harm to our country, and they have wives and children at home. One of them has a little child dying in hospital, so the Revolutionary Committee in Tehran has instructed me to see them across the border." He kept talking. From time to time, the deputy would interrupt him with a question. Whom did the Americans work for? What did they have with them? How did Rashid know they were not Savak agents spying for the counter-revolutionaries in Tabriz? For every question, Rashid had an answer, and a long one. While he was talking, he could be persuasive, whereas if he were silent, the others would have time to think of objections. People came in and went out continually. The deputy left three or four times. Eventually, he came in and said, "I have to clear this with Tehran." Rashid's heart sank. Of course, nobody in Tehran would verify his story, but it would take forever to get a call through. "Everything has been verified in Tehran, and there is no need to re-verify," he said. "But if you insist, I'll take these Americans to a hotel to wait." He added, "You had better send some guards with us." The deputy would have sent the guards anyway. Asking for them was a way of allaying suspicion. "I don't know," said the deputy. "This is not a good place to keep them," Rashid said. "It could cause trouble. They might be harmed." He held his breath. Here they were trapped. In a hotel, they would at least have the chance to make a break for the border. "Okay," said the deputy. Rashid concealed his relief. Paul was deeply grateful to see Rashid coming down the steps of the schoolhouse. It had been a long wait. Nobody had actually pointed guns at them, but they had got an awful lot of hostile looks. "We can go to the hotel," said Rashid. The Kurds from Mahabad shook hands with them and left in their ambulance. A few moments later, the Americans left in the two Range Rovers, followed by four or five armed guards in another car. They drove to the hotel. This time they all went in. There was an argument between the hotel keeper and the guards, but the guards won, and the Americans were assigned four rooms on the third floor at the back, and told to keep the curtains drawn and stay away from the windows in case local snipers thought Americans inviting targets. They gathered in one of the rooms. They could hear distant gunfire. Rashid organized lunch and ate with them, barbecued chicken, rice, bread, and coke. Then he left for the school. The guards wandered in and out of the room carrying their rifles. One of them struck Coburn as being evil. He was young, short, and muscular, with black hair and eyes like a snake. As the afternoon wore on, he seemed to get bored. One time he walked in and said, "Carter, no good." He looked around for a reaction. "CIA, no good," he said. "America, no good." Nobody replied. He went out. "That guy is trouble," Simon said calmly. "Don't anybody take the bait." The guard tried again a little later. "I am very strong," he said. "Wrestling. Wrestle champion. I went to Russia." He sat down and fiddled with his gun, as if he did not know how to load it. He appealed to Coburn. "You know guns?" Coburn shook his head. The guard looked at the others. "You know guns?" The gun was an M1, a weapon they were all familiar with, but nobody said anything. "You want to trade?" the guard said. "This gun for a backpack." Coburn said, "We don't have a backpack, and we don't want a gun." The guard gave up and went out into the corridor again. Simon said, "Where the hell is Rashid?"
The car hit a pothole, jolting Ralph Bulwer awake. He felt tired and groggy after his short, restless sleep. He looked through the windows. It was early morning. He saw the shore of a vast lake, so big he could not see the far side. "Where are we?" he said. "That's Lake Van," said Charlie Brown, the interpreter. There were houses and villages and civilian cars. They had come out of the wild mountain country and returned to what passed for civilization in this part of the world. Bulwer looked at a map. He figured they were about 100 miles from the border. "Hey, this is good," he said. He saw a filling station. They really were back in civilization. "Let's get gas," he said. At the filling station, they got bread and coffee. The coffee was almost as good as a shower. Bulwer felt raring to go. He said to Charlie, "Tell the old man I want to drive." The cabbie had been doing 30 or 40 miles per hour, but Bulwer pushed the ancient Chevrolet up to 70. It looked as though he had a real chance of getting to the border in time to meet Simons. Bowling along the lakeside road, Bulwer heard a muffled bang, followed by a tearing sound. Then the car began to buck and bump, and there was a screech of metal on stone. He had blown a tire. He braked hard, cursing. They all got out and looked at the wheel. Bulwer, the elderly cabbie, Charlie Brown, and Fat Ilseman. The tire was completely shredded and the wheel deformed, and they'd used the spare wheel during the night after the last blowout. Bulwer looked more closely. The wheel nuts had been stripped. Even if they could get another spare, they would not be able to remove the damaged wheel. Bulwer looked around. There was a house away up the hill. "Let's go there," Bulwer said. "We can phone." Charlie Brown shook his head. "No phones around here." Bulwer was not about to give up. After all he had gone through, he was too close. "Okay," he said to Charlie. "Hitch a ride back to the last town and get us another cab." Charlie started walking. Two cars passed him without stopping. Then a truck pulled up. It had hay and a bunch of children in the back. Charlie jumped in and the truck drove out of sight. Bulwer, Ilseman, and the cabbie stood looking at the lake, eating oranges. An hour later, a small European station wagon came tearing along the road and screeched to a halt. Charlie jumped out. Bulwer gave the driver from Madonna $500, then got into the new taxi with Ilseman and Charlie and drove off, leaving the Chevrolet beside the lake, looking like a beached whale. The new driver went like the wind, and by midday they were in Van, on the eastern shore of the lake. Van was a small town with brick buildings in the center and mud hut suburbs. Ilseman directed the driver to the home of a cousin of Mr. Fish. They paid their driver and went in. Ilseman got into a long discussion with Mr. Fish's cousin. Bulwer sat in the living room, listening but not understanding, impatient to get moving. After an hour, he said to Charlie, "Listen, let's just get another cab. We don't need the cousin." "It's a very bad place between here and the border," Charlie said. "We are foreigners. We need protection." Bulwer forced himself to be patient. At last, Ilseman shook hands with Mr. Fish's cousin, and Charlie said, "His sons will take us to the border." There were two sons and two cars. They drove up into the mountains. Bulwer saw no sign of the dangerous bandits against whom he was being protected. Just snow-covered fields, scrawny goats, and a few ragged people living in hovels. They were stopped by the police in the village of Yuksakova, a few miles from the border, and ordered into the little whitewashed police station. Ilseman showed his credentials, and they were quickly released. Bulwer was impressed. Maybe Ilseman really was with the Turkish equivalent of the CIA. They reached the border at 4 o'clock on Thursday afternoon, having been on the road for 24 hours. The border station was in the middle of nowhere. The guard post consisted of two wooden buildings. There was also a post office. Bulwer wondered who the hell used it. Truck drivers, perhaps. 200 yards away, on the Iranian side, was a bigger cluster of buildings. There was no sign of the dirty team. Bulwer felt angry. He'd broken his neck to get here more or less on time. Where the hell was Simons? A guard came out of one of the huts and approached him, saying, "Are you looking for the Americans?" Bulwer was surprised. The whole thing was supposed to be top secret. It looked like security had gone all to hell. "Yes," he said, "I'm looking for the Americans." "There's a phone call for you." Bulwer was even more surprised. No kidding. The timing was phenomenal. Who the hell knew he was here? He followed the guard into the hut and picked up the phone. "Yes?" "This is the American consulate," said the voice. "What's your name?" "What is this about?" Bulwer said warily. "Look, would you just tell me what you're doing there?" "I don't know who you are, and I'm not going to tell you what I'm doing." "Okay, listen. I know who you are, and I know what you're doing. If you have any problems, call me. Got a pencil?" Bulwer took down the number, thanked the man, and hung up, mystified. An hour ago, I didn't know I was going to be here, he thought. So how could anyone else? Least of all the American consulate. He thought again about Ilseman. Maybe Ilseman was in touch with his bosses, the Turkish MIT, who were in touch with the CIA, who were in touch with the consulate. Ilseman could have asked somebody to make a call for him in Van, or even at the police station in Yuksakova. He wondered whether it was good or bad that the consulate knew what was happening. He recalled the help Paul and Bill had got from the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. With friends in the State Department, a man had no need of enemies. He pushed the consulate to the back of his mind. The main problem now was, where was the dirty team? He went back outside and looked across no man's land. He decided to stroll across and talk to the Iranians. He called to Ilseman and Charlie Brown to come with him. As he approached the Iranian side, he could see that the frontier guards were not in uniform. Presumably, they were revolutionaries who had taken over when the government fell. He said to Charlie, "Ask them if they've heard anything about some American businessmen coming out in two jeeps." Charlie did not need to translate the reply. The Iranians shook their heads vigorously. An inquisitive tribesman, with a ragged headband and an ancient rifle, came up on the Iranian side. There was an exchange of some length, and Charlie said, "This man says he knows where the Americans are, and he will take you to them if you pay." Bulwer wanted to know how much, but Ilseman did not want him to accept the offer at any price. Ilseman spoke forcefully to Charlie, and Charlie translated. "You're wearing a leather coat and leather gloves and a fine wristwatch." Bulwer, who was into watches, was wearing one Mary had given him when they got married. "So?"
With clothes like that, they think you're a Sabak. They hate Sabak over there. I'll change my clothes. I have another coat in the car. No, Charlie said. You have to understand, they just want to get you over there and blow your head off.
All right, Bulwer said. They walked back to the Turkish side. Since there was a post office so conveniently nearby, he decided to call Istanbul and check in with Ross Perot. He went into the post office. He had to sign his name. The call would take some time to place, the clerk told him. Bulwer went back outside. The Turkish border guards were now getting edgy, Charlie told them. Some of the Iranians had wandered back with them, and the guards did not like people milling around in no man's land. It was disorderly. Bulwer thought, well, I'm doing no good here. He said, would these guys call us if the team comes across while we're back in Yuksakova? Charlie asked them. The guards agreed. There was a hotel in the village, they said. They would call there. Bulwer, Ilsman, Charlie, and the two sons of Mr. Fish's cousin got into the two cars and drove back to Yuksakova. There they checked into the worst hotel in the whole world. It had dirt floors. The bathroom was a hole in the ground under the stairs. All the beds were in one room. Charlie Brown ordered food, and it came wrapped in newspaper. Bulwer was not sure he had made the right decision in leaving the border station. So many things could go wrong. The guards might not phone as they had promised. He decided to accept the offer of help from the American consulate and ask them to seek permission for him to stay at the border station. He called the number he'd been given on the hotel's single